content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with The Pain and Glory of Summer, written by Elizabeth Brunick. Summer always overstays its welcome by about a month. After the 4th of July, which has its charms, nothing but a stretch of relentless heat lies ahead, reaching toward Labor Day, and I begin to yearn for fall. So does the grand, semi-malevolent intelligence that organizes American consumption. By mid-August, grocery stores are stocking their shelves with autumnal goods, pumpkin pie Pop-Tarts, cinnamon maple frosted flakes, pumpkin spice cinnamon rolls in pressurized cardboard tubes. As I stroll through the aisles, I gaze wistfully at candy corn, while the frosty supermarket air cools the sweat I worked up walking to the store beneath the blazing sun. Late September can't arrive soon enough. This summer has been especially hot, worse than most years. Heat waves killed at least 14,000 people in Europe. Parts of France recorded 110-degree temperatures in June. Wildfires raged across North America, torching more than 4.5 million acres in Canada and parts of the United States, and forcing 60,000 people to evacuate their homes. The Canadian fires sent heavy smoke bellowing over the Northeast, coloring the sky, contaminating the air, and forcing all activities indoors. The warming climate has brought too many ticks and a 10 to 15% rise in mosquitoes, along with raised red welts and transmitted viruses. All of this was on my mind as I slathered my children with insect repellent and sunscreen before sending them off to local playgrounds half-consumed by green overgrowth, poison ivy lurking among the leaves. Still, no amount of well-intended prophylaxis stands a chance against little hands and streams of sweat. The season comes with a chaotic flurry of activity as the last school bell gives way to day camps, sleepaway camps, and hastily cobbled together child care spread out with luck among families and friends. Unwieldy arrangements that cost the average parent thousands of dollars each a year. My two daughters arrive home from day camp hours before the workday is done, with dirt on their knees and popsicle sticks between their teeth. I scramble to squeeze in snacks and entertainment between sentences. Peanut butter and jelly crackers here, a paint-by-number kit there. Both kids as bored as I am busy. The front yard is apparently too flat to supply sufficient fun on the slip and slide, though my daughters still scoot valiantly on it when the afternoon grows too monotonous. I hose the grass off their feet and lay down towels before they come back inside, then stay up late doing dishes and laundry after they go to bed. Another item of business. Both children have summer birthdays, and the pressure of whipping up summertime birthday parties can be enormous. Convening dozens of children during vacation season takes some wrangling. This year I packed 26 piping bags of icing in a rainbow of pastel colors and made tiny cakes for one daughter and her friends to decorate while seated at a long folding table in the back patio. I also lugged a helium tank and bags of banners, tablecloths, hats, and balloons to the ice skating rink and nervously prayed that enough kids would show up to satisfy my other daughter. It all transpired smoothly in the end. And then I found myself with cake crumbs on my shorts and a 10-year-old and 7-year-old wondering where the time had gone. Summer drags on, but then feels fleeting. It's hard not to experience a certain nostalgia for the moments as they pass. Still, one works up a sweat managing the hours, such that it comes as something of a relief when the kids abscond to sleepaway camp for a couple of weeks or to the beach with Grandma and Grandpa for a little while. The house is clean and quiet, and work gets done. I comb through their old clothes, folding the old ones into donation bags to make room for back-to-school outfits, that are one or two sizes larger than last year's. But there are still a few weeks of summer left when they come home, and though there are dishes in the sink, mud tracks on the floor, and deadlines to meet, I join them on their adventures. We sail across the New York Harbor by ferry to Governor's Island, a kid's oasis, where the fresh waters of the Hudson stream into the salty Atlantic Ocean. There are food trucks, ice cream stands, enormous slides, and a massive junkyard playground where kids can splatter paint across scrap wood and mount precariously assembled tire forts. It is hot, searing hot, but what I see when I squint through the sweat is resplendent. Kids climbing the structures of their own worlds. My two daughters are golden-skinned with sun bleach, braids. Their fine, downy body hair catches the light, lending them an ethereal glow. They look like young gods in the summertime of their lives. This season is their season. The junkyard play feels a little dangerous, but it's their beauty, not their vulnerability, that transfixes me. When night comes, I help them ignite leftover sparklers, which illuminate their faces with silvery starlight. Fall arrives like a fever breaking. Mayhem gives way to order, and adventures give way to routines. A cool calmness presides over suburbia, and as I heave heavy pumpkins into my cart at Costco, I know that I will soon get what I have eagerly anticipated, darkness and quiet, discipline and fruitful maturity. I will clock out of work for the day just as the children arrive home from school, hang their backpacks by the door, and huddle around the kitchen table. They will have spent their day learning new skills and new social norms, developing their friendships and knowledge of the world. All of this will change them, subtly but certainly. At these ages, they are constantly being reborn. They still need me to help them with their homework, and they still need me to serve them dinner as the evening proceeds. But they will need me less than they did last year, and next year even less. As I watch them diligently spell out answers on their worksheets, I will wish that summer had lasted forever. Next, the researchers who want dads to be to stop drinking. If you're actively trying to have babies, one expert told me, both the man and the woman should be abstaining from alcohol. This is written by Olga Kazan. Pretty much everyone knows that women aren't supposed to have alcohol while they're pregnant. Even just a drink a day, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists warns, can cause lifelong problems with a baby's coordination, behavior, and learning. Not all mothers-to-be follow this advice, of course, but the official guidance is clear. There is no safe amount or type of alcohol use during pregnancy. Male drinking and its potential negative effects on a fetus have gotten considerably less attention. The ACOG does not have the same alcohol-related recommendations for men on its website, and doctors do not generally bring up the topic in prenatal appointments. A few years ago, however, Kara Thomas, then a graduate student at Texas A&M University's veterinary school, suggested an experiment that would explore whether a father-to-be's alcohol consumption could also pose risks. She wanted to see whether alcohol used by a male mouse before impregnating a female mouse might change the facial features of the resulting fetus. The student's professor, Michael Golding, was initially against the idea. He assumed that a fetus would need to be exposed to a toxic level of alcohol for its face to be affected, a level that typically comes from heavy drinking by the mother during pregnancy, not from drinking by the father before pregnancy. When that was wrong, I was stunned, Golding told me. The study results showed that when a male mouse drank alcohol, then impregnated a female mouse that was not given alcohol, their fetuses tended to develop facial changes, such as smaller jaws, similar to those in some human children with fetal alcohol syndrome. Since then, Golding's team has found a variety of other ways that alcohol consumed by the father before conception can affect a fetus. Among the issues Golding has seen in the offspring of alcohol-using mouse fathers compared with children of control mice are higher inflammation, liver damage, accelerated aging, and changes in the retina. The team's research has also found that male preconception alcohol use can result in problems with the placenta and worse IVF success rates. All of Golding's studies use mice because researchers cannot deliberately expose prospective human parents to alcohol. He noted that the alcohol metabolism pathways in mice and humans are similar, and that therefore one could expect similar effects of preconception alcohol use between the two species. Other research has resulted in similar findings. Kelly Huffman, a psychologist at UC Riverside, has found changes in the neocortex, worsened coordination, and impaired motor learning in the offspring of mice whose fathers were heavily dosed with alcohol prior to their conception, compared with control mice. These findings have led Golding, Huffman, and others to recommend that men stop drinking if they're trying to become fathers. Golding said he thinks that the harmful effects happen because alcohol puts the mouse father into a state of oxidative stress, and this may cause his sperm to dial down the mitochondrial and metabolism functions of any potential new embryo that it creates. Through a process called epigenetics, the alcohol-affected sperm may carry chemical instructions that alter the way the genes are expressed in the embryo, leading to an array of changes in the fetus. Some human studies point to a similar phenomenon at play. Along with his colleagues, Greg Humanigs, a molecular neurobiologist at the University of Pittsburgh, has found that in humans, a parent or even grandparents' alcohol use disorder was associated with changes in gene expression in hundreds of their children's and grandchildren's genes, including in those related to cancer development. As concerning as this research may seem, it remains rife with unanswered questions. Golding said that the precise dose of alcohol that's harmful in humans is not clear, but chronic drinking is likely worse than occasional drinking because the former is more of a stressor on the body. In some of Huffman's studies, the mice are held at a human equivalent of a 0.08 blood alcohol level or the United States' legal driving limit, but few people maintain that level all day, every day. And researchers don't know yet whether preconception alcohol use has any effect on a woman's eggs, because eggs are harder to study than sperm and don't regenerate. Also unknown is how long prior to conception a father's drinking might matter, or whether alcohol poses a greater risk than other substances or behaviors. Work on the parental consumption of THC, the primary active chemical in marijuana, for instance, has so far produced small or inconsistent findings, but parental obesity might be consequential. Sarah Kimmins, an epigenetics expert at the University of Montreal, has found that men with an elevated body mass index, or BMI, tend to have sperm with altered DNA methylation, chemical signals that could change the development of embryo or placenta in areas linked to neural development. This potentially provides one explanation for why some studies show that obese men are more likely to have children with autism. I asked Golding and Humanics why, given their research, more kids don't have symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome or other related problems. Most American men drink, after all, which might suggest that most American kids would have these issues. Humanics told me that not every man who consumes alcohol will cause harm to his future child. His genetic susceptibility and the amount he drinks might play a role. Golding said that fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are, quote, grossly underdiagnosed, end quote, and that therefore more children might have the condition than we think. Perhaps the biggest caveat to all of this is why so many of these studies have shown effects only in mice. Several studies of human paternal drinking, which largely rely on retroactive reports of alcohol consumption, have found associations with fetal size, congenital heart diseases, birth defects, and infant mortality risk. The evidence, however, is inconsistent and not necessarily causal. And some scientists are skeptical of the epigenetical mechanism that Golding and others describe. To me, the idea that sperm mitochondria would pick up heritable defects and transfer them to the offspring is a stretch. Adrian Bird, a genetics professor at the University of Edinburgh, told me, "There may be something going on here, but I would need to see it reproduced independently with large numbers of animals before being convinced." Still, Golding said that, given what he and others have found, men should avoid alcohol for about 90 days before attempting to get their partner pregnant. "The less you drink, the healthier you're going to be," he said. However, some traces of past debauchery might be irreversible. Kimmins told me ominously that we don't actually know how much you can reverse damage done from bad habits earlier in life. Huffman had similar advice. "If you're actively trying to have babies," she said, "both the man and the woman should be abstaining from alcohol." Kimmins was even more expansive in her warnings. She argued that, for the sake of future generations, men should aim to live extremely healthy lives, not only in terms of their alcohol consumption, but in every dimension. "Eating well is what men should be doing," Kimmins said. "How a father lives his life will definitely impact the health of his sperm epigenome, his fertility, and then can impact the next generation." Just as I was about to point out to Huffman that occasional drinking is broadly accepted by society, she told me, "Biology doesn't care what's legal." I worried aloud that this advice, even if warranted, might not be realistic. Birth rates are declining in much of the world because many people have become reluctant to start families. Telling men to completely stop drinking for months before they even attempt to become fathers doesn't seem like it would help fertility. Huffman saw it differently. "We spend a lot of our lives sacrificing for our children," she said. "I think it's not a massive ask for us to get used to it early." Perhaps a gentler takeaway from this research is that doctors could do more to scrutinize the father's health when a couple are planning a family or experiencing fertility struggles. Women are told to avoid deli meats, soft cheeses, and even a drop of alcohol during pregnancy. But Golden's research and similar studies suggest that a prospective father's health behaviors can also be important. If a couple struggle to conceive, for instance, the man's diet or alcohol use could be affecting fertility. I think the message definitely needs to get out that men also have a responsibility for their children's health, Kimmins said. Maybe, then, the question becomes one of relative sacrifice. If the couple conceive, the pregnant woman will have to endure the better part of a year, a stretch of time that may be filled with awkward work parties and weddings of people she barely knows, without so much of it as a glass of wine. In solidarity, her partner can probably spend a few months cutting back. Our third story comes from the music department. "A Perfect Album for a Frustrating Decade." This is written by Spencer Kornhaber. One of the coronavirus pandemic's many terrible legacies is the slow smothering of ambition in popular culture. In the depths of the crisis, media, music, movies, and all the rest were widely hailed as a balm for anxieties and a lifeline to the shared society we could look forward to someday returning to. Yet at the same time, that pre-pandemic sense of cohesion was being destabilized. Entertainers emerged from lockdown to find their fans wild-eyed with obsession and everyone else utterly unreachable. The ensuing years in the arts have felt strange and stilted, defined by stalled dreams, a shattered common stage, and a nervous relationship between artists and audiences. The Southern California folk singer Phoebe Bridgers, last name is B-R-I-D-G-E-R-S, Bridgers, is one artist who experienced the unique intensity of a pandemic breakthrough. In June of 2020, her hushed and biting second album, Punisher, was received with the sort of acclaim suggesting the arrival of the next great American songwriter. She was funny and thoughtful on social media, and fans came to regard her with all the intimacy of a best friend, despite her requests for them to step back and respect boundaries. Now, after more than half a decade, she's released her third full-length album, Lost Weekend, a beautiful but frustrating document of post-pandemic disappointment. From her early days drawing buzz as a teenage disciple of pillow-voiced balladeers, such as John Lennon and Elliott Smith, Bridger's appeal has lain in her ambivalence. She is an adventurer with a reclusive streak. She wants to see the world outside of her phone and then get back in bed. Many of her songs play like travelogues through a corrupted civilization, its skies littered with chemtrails and satellites, its bars patrolled by users and abusers. Her sighing style of singing and the downward lilt of her melodies suggest that the world's fallen nature simply tires her out. "There's no place like my room," she sings, on Punisher's closing track, "I Know the End." In the years after that album, Bridgers didn't actually disappear. She collaborated with the likes of Paul McCartney, SZA, and Taylor Swift, who proclaimed she is the reference now for modern songwriters. She released a splashy album with the supergroup Boy Genius, but none of this work had the sheer density of insight, the line-after-line sense of surprise that has defined Bridger's solo music. Her 2017 single, Motion Sickness, begins, "I hate you for what you did, and I miss you like a little kid. I faked it every time, but that's all right." Earlier this year, she embarked on a tour in which audience members were banned from using their phones, a sign that she was coming back to her main project on her own, self-protected terms. On paper, Lost Weekend is everything that the follow-up to a breakthrough should be. Epic-scaled, richly orchestrated, musically evolutionary. A glittering cast of collaborators include the hit-making producer Jack Antonoff, the Pulitzer-winning composer Caroline Shaw, and indie multi-instrumentalist Alex G, the mandolin-wielding MacArthur Fellow Chris Teal, and, suspectedly under a pseudonym, the It Boy vocalist of 2020's rock, Geese's Cameron Winter. They've created a moody, varied soundscape featuring drum machines, hard guitars, and oozes of country plucking. The first three songs are stunning. The Outside opens with Bridgers alternating between Laurie Anderson-style vocoder confessions and swirling piano paired with clean vocals. As she moves from the inorganic to the organic and back again, she also slips between tempos for an effect as mesmerizing as a shadow flickering in the stream. Then comes Lost Boys, a should-be smash single in which layers of chiming instruments coalesce into one swinging, shaggy mass. On Kill Me, rustling guitars convey cold unease until the chorus offers a hint of warmth. "This is gonna kill me," sings Bridgers. Then she pauses to add offbeat, "Wait." These early tracks portray Bridgers at the height of her success, crowd surfing at concerts and surrounded by friends, yet feeling alienated. "I pretended it was make-believe," goes the great line from Lost Boys, capturing the psychological trickery that results from disassociating from one's own life. When Kill Me crescendos in gang-sung cries of "Let's go missing," it's an exciting cliffhanger. Bridgers sounds poised to take the listener down a rabbit hole, somewhere fantastical and fresh. Instead, reality persists, murky and enervating. The Governor's Waltz finds her at a famous music festival, feeling, yet again, disconnected and on edge. Fingerpick guitars and toy box melodies are creepy yet obvious, like a Tim Burton movie. The lyrics bait gossip blogs by seeming to refer to an ex and the girl he replaced her with. These blind items should be interesting. Bridgers once knew how to make inside jokes land for everyone. But many of her descriptions across the album are naggingly opaque or inert. "You had a nosebleed, you were in my way, and you didn't remind me of anything," she sings, a line that's intriguing only because it hints at her own creative blockage. She's enlisted a prestigious mishmash of stars to whip up variations on two moods, looming dread and wistful uplift. The story she's telling should have been strong enough to land without so much filigree. On Standing Still, she seems to refer to abuse of her mother by her father, who died in late 2020. Rather than just condemning him, Bridgers spends part of an album examining the traits he passed on to her, for good and ill. At the same time, she's wrestling with a fatalistic view of fame. "Surviving my gift until I get shot," she sings on the title track, a chilling line on an album with a Lennon-inspired name. Her personal demons and public pressures really do sound suffocating. Can she possibly escape them? The twist of Lost Weekend is that it suggests a happy answer to that question. On The Roaring and Catching Bobby, she sings about a blissful home life with a lover who also shows up as a savior figure in other songs. Their meet-cute seems to be described in the first line. "I saw you slow dancing alone in your room." Bobby is almost certainly her real boyfriend, and she's implying that she fell for him while watching his acclaimed Netflix special, a document of stir-crazed social isolation. Virtual desire becoming real, isolation giving way to communion, a life built outside the digital panopticon. These are powerful themes for the 2020s, but too often the album meets its moment in a sad way, with strained, distant songwriting that suggests its creator's hesitation about reconnecting with the crowd. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.